I don't know. A lighting man, I suppose.
Yeah. Have you any idea what happened to that?
No.
It might still be around?
No, there isn't a thing that I can think of.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, well. Have to keep plodding on with this.
Let me see.
I know, I came across the other day the correspondence ordering the Steinway Grand. It was, I forget what date, but...
Yes.
From some outfit in Toronto.
I was just wondering whether it moved to Shannon or not. No, it didn't. Oh, I think she gave it to my son. Her son, Ernest.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the Steinway.
Mm-hmm. So that Irene Rogers might have it then?
Well, actually, she gave it away by mistake, I think.
Oh.
I think, but anyhow, they wouldn't be interesting, where it is, would it?
It's something that was connected with him personally, you see. And,
well, I imagine it's the piano you're talking about is
not
that not. One.
Yeah.
A Steinway. I know it was a Steinway.
Yeah.
And when my sister-in-law, Irene, moved out of her house after her husband was drowned, she was storing things, and I think somebody said to her it was a pity to store a piano, you know, not have it used. And she had said to the nurse's residence of the Vancouver General Hospital that they could have it in their reception room, you know. They thought she was giving it to them, and so they wrote and thanked her very much for the present. So she didn't like to ask for it back again.
So as far as you know, it's still there?
Yes.
Ah.
But however,
mm.
That is, if you see her, I don't know if you do.
I intend to.
Well, you can ask her if that is the piano.
Uh-huh.
But I doubt if she would know whether it was or not, you see. Because, after all, she was my friend, school friend.
Oh, yes.
And so she used to come with me as a on the quillo quite often. But she didn't know my father so well as all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so she wouldn't know whether that piano was one that he had bought from.
Yeah. Well, except
I couldn't say whether it was or not.
Yeah. Except that that perhaps Ernest might have known specifically that it did. Said to her...
Well, it was in Davie Street.
Yeah.
If it was in Davie Street and that was a Steinway, it probably was the same piano.
Yeah.
Maybe the same one that's down in the...
Yeah.
Mrs. Irene would know.
Yeah. The nurse's residence, that's at the General, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Anyhow, it isn't terribly important, but
no.
There's one other thing that we touched upon earlier a little bit that I'd like to go over. Do you remember any other specific business things that he was into? I know he was in real estate deals and things like that. Do you remember any other particular thing?
Well, I chiefly remember the salmon canning pan which Mr. Powell was interested in because my father gave me some shares in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget what they paid the first year. It was phenomenal anyhow, you know, 100% or something crazy. And, of course, I thought that was going to happen every year.
Oh, yeah.
I think he got out of that business. No, I have no idea. But probably in my mother's diaries there would be said.
References to it.
I had various things like that.
Yeah. At a subsequent interview with Mrs. Chernyavsky, it seemed more appropriate not to use the tape recorder, since she had not responded very well to it and seemed somewhat perturbed by its presence in front of her. I therefore took extensive notes, and I am now reading these into the tape in the order that they were taken down. Apparently, BT had a phobia against Jews. The kind of comment that he would make would be, "Jews never take a bath." Apparently, he had some experiences in New York City which led him to regard all Jews as a bad lot. This was unfortunate, since his two daughters formed a friendship with the two members of the Chernyavsky trio, who were born of Jewish parents, although probably they themselves knew very little about the Jewish faith or anything of that kind. I mean, just Russian persons. Anyhow, they were invited for a weekend aboard the Aquila, and BT apparently caught the elder brother kissing his daughter Mary good night. The Aquila was promptly turned round, and the two boys were dumped unceremoniously ashore without any goodbyes. And that, as far as BT was concerned, was to be the last his daughters would ever see of these two gentlemen. Of course, that didn't work out. Mary was packed off to school in the East with a diamond watch to console her. And, of course, not too long after that, the Chernyavsky trio came to perform in New York, and the friendship was renewed without the knowledge of Benjamin. Although BT himself was not particularly musical, he enjoyed scraping away at a violin, and there are some photographs which show him playing the fool in a mock orchestra aboard the Aquila. She also mentioned further details about the Aquila, how the five-man crew were drilled as if the, more or less as if it was a Navy vessel, and when people were taken ashore in the longboat, the sailors would come up with the oars raised in the air in true naval fashion. BT also apparently loved horses throughout his life and continued to enjoy riding up until his death. In the diaries of his wife, of course, there are many references to the horses and to driving out with the horses at the house in Davy Street. They had five horses in a stable behind the house, and Mrs. Chernyavsky remembers her own horse, which just used to run away with her consistently, and she'd go riding in Stanley Park, and they would meet a steam engine of some kind at the entrance to the park. The horse would then bolt, and she would hang on for dear life as the horse pelted back to its stable on Davy Street. Another story about BT and his, you can call it, intolerance of damn foreigners, etc. At the outbreak of the First World War, they were in a New York hotel, and BT remarked to the waiter, who had been extremely helpful to them while they were there, and Elspeth actually had a crush on him. BT said, "Any of these damn Germans about here?" And the waiter replied, "Oh no, sir. Only myself and the manager." This BT thought was a great joke. Apparently, possibly another cause of his dislike of the Chernyavsky brothers and their involvement with his daughter was that he didn't like musicians in general, perhaps considering them as as a rather shiftless lot, an unsuitable match for his daughter. And apparently, in general, he didn't care for foreigners very much, and so they were also Russian. He may have found out that they were Jewish also, and this may have contributed to the thing. I asked persistently whether BT was a prude in sexual matters, but she seemed reticent or confused about the question, and she did not seem to understand that I was trying to establish whether it was the shock of seeing his daughter actually kissing that he was offended by, but generally I don't think she thought that this was so much important. It was rather a sort of Russian musician, Jewish, and
hanky-panky on my boat, which he wouldn't tolerate. He was known as Dada by his children. There is an incident. He had a sister, Claire, who he looked after when his brothers had died, and his mother moved up and lived with the family in Vancouver. And there were two sisters. One, Emma, married an extremely bigoted Roman Catholic, perhaps bigoted is the wrong word, but a very dedicated Roman Catholic who wouldn't set foot in a Protestant church. Anyhow, although this man perhaps made himself rather unpleasant, BT never cut himself off from Emma. On the other hand, his sister Claire, who apparently seems to have been rather the spoiled baby of the family, and somewhat jealous of BT's success and of BT's wife Bella's stature as a consequence of BT's success. Claire married a Mr. Wright, that BT could not stand. Apparently he was a bit foppish, and she used to massage his legs in public and so on and so forth, and BT thought this was dreadful. Anyhow, eventually they had a quarrel, and sometime in the early 1900s, some years after her marriage, and then as a consequence, BT then never said a word to her again. That was the total cut-off. Never referred to her, and there was no contact between the two families ever after that. We also talked at some length about various members of the refinery, which I'll refer to later. I'll skip over here a bit. Okay. Mary and Elspeth apparently were given a Chevrolet, a present, which they shared. This was sometime during the First World War, I guess. Elspeth started driving when she was 16. Another thing about Mary, apparently she was a rather opinionated person, tough-minded, quite intellectual, and she never really got along with Benjamin Rogers, her father. And it may be that this was another cause why the Cherniaski boy was kicked so unceremoniously off the boat. Simply that BT didn't like Mary that much. Anyway, Mary apparently never got on with any members of the family until recent years, and has gone off and lived in Europe. She apparently acquired a kind of snobbishness while she was sent away to school in England, and rather looked down on the rough colonial society of Vancouver. Elspeth thinks that BT was too impatient a man to play golf, although he did try, didn't make much of a success of it. She also thinks that although he enjoyed fishing very much, he would not have been patient enough for fly fishing and would have preferred the more immediate results of trolling. One aspect of his character which is worth noting was that she already mentioned on the tape, that is, he was very kind about presents. He was extremely good at thinking up presents and really enjoyed thinking up presents. His wife, on the other hand, was rather more Scottish in this respect and didn't like his extravagance, whereas BT just loved spending money and would really buy most expensive presents and just loved doing it. He was extremely particular about his clothes. He was clothed by the best outfitters in New York, the Brooke brothers. He would buy nothing but the best and had a considerable wardrobe. He was a very generous man, but he didn't like this to be public knowledge. He was generous in a private way and didn't consider it a big thing. If somebody was in trouble, he would aid them, but it wouldn't be a big issue with him. It's rather a nice thing, perhaps. Elspeth, these comments are all from Elspeth, and Elspeth is the first one to say, and I should have noted this at the beginning of the tape, that she is very eager to disqualify herself and point out that her knowledge of her father was from the point of view of a 16, 17-year-old who absolutely adored him, and that her remarks should be taken with that bias in mind. And she is constantly saying such things as, that is my thought, that is my opinion, that is my recollection. She's very anxious that we realize that her memory is not so great that and that her recollection is biased by her being the loving daughter. Anyhow, it is her recollection that VT perhaps was a little bit, not really frightened, but a little bit awed by his wife periodically, and she kept him in line a little bit. She apparently had a tremendous respect for wealth, and perhaps, this is my judgment, perhaps thought that BT should be a little more solemn about his success, whereas BT just liked to enjoy it. She apparently had some very rich cousins in Montreal, rich before she came to Canada, and she would very much respected these people. These are the Agnesses, who was the founder of the Bank of Montreal, one of the early directors. And BT used to kid her about her fancy cousins in Montreal. His wife, Mary Isabella, Bella as she was known, was very distant with servants and never formed any sort of an attachment with them, and they never became sort of old retainers and friends of hers. She was extremely distant, even with people who were with them for years and years. For example, there was the governess, Pat, who became a dear friend of Elspeth and a confidant, and when Elspeth was corresponding with Jan Czerniawski in secret, the letters would be sent to Pat, the old governess, and then passed on to Elspeth. But MIR never had any relationship with this lady, Pat. It was Miss Patterson, Pat as a nickname. Pat was quite scared of her, and apparently this was general. She was rather a frightening old lady in some respects, and that this characteristic had developed from very early on. And she would, for example, not like anything, well, this is not for example, but considering a new thought, BT loved to try out new things. He enjoyed new kitchen appliances or home appliances of any kind, anything to save effort, etc. And they had, an ice machine when it first came out, and it was an extremely noisy and smelly thing, but BT liked it because it was a new modern invention, that sort of thing. There was no, apparently, snobbishness about him. He came from a very impressive American lineage, Huguenot ancestors dating back way back. But BT didn't think anything of this. He was not impressed at all by his ancestry. The thing what impressed him was ability. And his wife apparently was a little bit more impressed by society, perhaps. But I think perhaps just great wealth. Anyhow, that's off the record, really. Another characteristic of Ben's, of course, he thought government was a dreadful thing. And when the income tax was imposed at the beginning of the First World War, he thought the world had come to an end. With his children, apparently, he was very doting with Elspeth and very loving with the small children, played the sort of jolly father with them. Apparently Mary didn't get on too well with him. He was a stern father, however, with the boys. It's with Blythe and Ernest. They used to be the most frightful rows between Blythe and BT during the war, after Blythe had come back and was working in the refinery, over refinery matters. Blythe was apparently quick-tempered, extremely personable and clever person, and strong-minded, like his father. And there would be this furious rows, and Elspeth would run from the house with her ears blocked and just run away to her neighbours. And these things apparently were not uncommon, but they were not, they were over business and just a straightforward argument, and BT simply did not really care for anybody to contradict him. He preferred people who simply took his order, who were able. Yes, he admired ability, but I think in his staff and probably in his sons he preferred obedience and agreement to questioning his own point of view. Anyhow, this is perhaps shown by some of the people he chose in the business. Anyhow, some more thing about Mary Rogers, his wife, M.I.R., as she's known as, she wouldn't say a word about anything private. She just wouldn't. She would clam up totally. It's an instance of this. Her diary is totally impersonal. It could be published, as Elspeth says, on the front page of the Province, and nobody'd really find the breath of scandal in it. Although it is full of fascinating historical details about the times and about Ben Rogers. But as another instance of her total dedication to privacy is that Elspeth and her husband Jan came and lived with old Mrs. Rogers for the last 30 years of her life, approximately. And this apparently was a great joy to M.I.R., but she never said one word to them about it at all. And it wasn't until after her death that a friend told Elspeth that her mother had once confided to this friend what a great joy and a great solace it was to have Elspeth and Jan living in the house, but she never gave any intimation of how she felt to Elspeth. To talk now about some of the sons as directors, Elspeth says that Phipp, unfortunately, was a drinker. He was a man probably with a deep inferiority complex, which he, and then he, the presidency was rather thrust upon him by the sudden and unexpected death of Ernest, who was drowned. And that he perhaps wasn't really ready for it, nor was he ever character-wise the sort of person who would naturally have expected it to come to him. So that feeling that he was unable, perhaps, to, or unqualified or whatever, for this position, he resorted to liquor, and he used to get just bombed out of his mind, apparently. And I asked Elspeth, could one say that he drank himself to death, and he did die young, and she said yes. This is not recorded for gossip, but just to help anybody who may be interested in the future to evaluate the period of Phipp's presidency of the company. It was Phipp who authorized the Ozama involvement in Santo Domingo, and if you cross-check on Mr. Dunlop's tape, you'll find that Dunlop was against it right from the start, and thinks that it was a mistake right from the start. And apparently Phipp took the advice, this is according to Elspeth, and again this is Elspeth's recollection, which she would want to qualify pretty heavily, that it was a part-time friend of Phipp by the name of Hobbs, who was in some way connected with the sugar business, who strongly advised or gave Phipp the advice or put the idea into his head to get involved in the Santo Domingo Ozama project. Phipp, however, was a sort of fairly venturesome person, and so for all how that fits in with inferiority complex, I don't know. But this is Elspeth's opinion. She said both Ernest and Phipp had extremely good senses of humour, Ernie in particular. And she also added that Phipp was extremely diffident, although very generous. Diffident and generous. Anyhow, to turn now to two of the other officers of the company. Mr. Adamson, who was, I believe, the secretary, who was hired by BT, was absolutely devoted to BT, absolute slave of the company. He was a dour Scot, honest as the day is long, did exactly what he was told, was frightened of his own shadow, had a very bleak outlook on the world, lived with a bunch of other old bachelors somewhere downtown, and totally unimaginative, took no responsibility, but did exactly everything he was told and was totally loyal. He must have been capable, but he was no imagination at all. Apparently he also took to drink, And according to Elspeth, she found out some years after his death that he had in fact committed suicide. There's an instance about his character that he once became ill, and Elspeth and Margaret, her younger sister, fixed up an apartment for him to move into when he came out of hospital, and they had great fun of doing it, of course, but although he did move into the apartment, he never gave them one word of thanks for it. At one point, some short while before his death, he asked her what he should do with his money, and she suggested that he leave it to the Dr. Bernardo's home on Victoria, on Vancouver Island. And he said, well, is that or his two old-aged sisters, who had more than enough to live on, apparently, and were in their 80s. But anyhow, when he did die, he left it all to his sisters. And she thinks that he may simply have forgotten to change his will, but she also thinks possibly indicative of his sort of total lack of imagination. Johnson, I asked about Fordham Johnson, who was apparently taken on by Benjamin, and initially was quite a friend of Ben's, and apparently his wife was a very close friend, one of the few, very few close friends that Mary Isabella Rogers made, and this lady died young, and that after her death, the relationship of the Johnsons to the Rogers was changed. Apparently, Johnson went on to marry a wealthy widow, and then after he had become, Ben died, and Blythe took over the presidency, Johnson was the vice president, but apparently gave Blythe very little help at all. According to Elspeth. And then after Blythe's death, he took over the company, and she hedged. She frankly did not know of the nature of any wrongdoing of Mr. Johnson, but she suspected that he had, although the company had done a great deal by him and the Rogers family had done a great deal for him, that he did not respond in kind. He became extremely pompous, and at the same time, although he had acquired considerable wealth, he remained very stingy, so much so that they used to call him around town. His name was Fordham Johnson. They used to nickname him Cantor Fordham Johnson. And Mary Isabella, BT's wife, was extremely disappointed in him. His rise was totally due to BTR, that he evidently felt no gratitude at all. And when he became president of the company, he acted the big shot, became extremely pompous and would hardly talk to anybody. And then, of course, when finally he went on to become lieutenant governor, he would only talk after that to God and the Queen. She also pointed out that Phipp was unhappily married, and this may have also been a cause of his drinking. It's not unlikely that I shall get further notes from Mrs. Rogers, from Elspeth, as the time goes on. I shall read these in, as I have done these. I don't think there's much point taking the tape recorder to see her. These are some further notes that were taken during a conversation between myself, Mrs. Cherniavsky, and Mrs. K. Bell Irving of West Vancouver, who was a childhood friend of Elspeth's and of Mary, Elspeth's elder sister. According to Mrs. Irving's recollection, B.T. was devoted to his wife Bella and loyal to his wife Bella. He was the first in town, as far as she's aware, or one of the first, to have a gramophone, and she remembers going up to the house and dancing. Strike dancing, and listening to the latest recordings of people like Caruso or whoever was popular at that time. Houdini, the juggler acrobat, came to the Davy Street house to entertain the family privately after he had been engaged by the Vancouver Club. BT enjoyed being Santa Claus at Christmas and was very good of it, good at it. Went on board the Aquilo. A friend of BT's called Wally Page Powell used to take BT silver fizz, a kind of cocktail, first thing in the morning on a silver platter. The color of the Pierce Arrow, according to them, was yellow. I think we've also heard that it was blue. It was number 6 in the province. The first car was the electric car, which was very high. BT used to refer to Mrs. Bell Irving and her and her friend Mary Rogers and another friend as the three buds. Apparently they were more or less inseparable companions. One of the frequent trips made on the Aquila was to Thetis Island. Another one was to Todd Inlet, where they would visit the Bouchard private residence, now public, where the gardens were lovely then. Mr. Bouchard being a friend of B.T. Rogers, a man who was in the cement business. Dr. Bell Irving was an old Scot, K. Watson, married his son. And Dr. Bell Irving was the family doctor for a while, or perhaps for a long time, of the Rogers family. That is recorded in Bella's diaries. There was a canner, Bell Irving, also, of the ABC Packers, I think it was, who did not see eye to eye with Benjamin Rogers. He was very much a proper sort of gentleman. BT was more flamboyant. KBI, K. Bell Irving's father was a Mr. Watson, who was in the drug business, admired BT Rogers greatly, and thought that BT would have made a far greater fortune had he not died. He used to be fond of saying that that man would have died very rich indeed. Mr. Page Powell, the friend, possibly is Salmon Man, was a fabulous cocktail mixer. He had stutter, but he used to look after the bar on the Aquilo, more or less, although they did have a steward for such purposes. There was a sailor called Petrie, of whom we actually have a photograph, who was in charge of the crew, the senior crew member, and there were four others. The engineer, whose name was Niven, William, the sort of butler steward, another sailor, and a Chinese cook. On the board, when BT was on board, the ship flew the letter R, his house flag, from the mast. Everything had to be absolutely shipshape on board. Another friend of BT's was a Mr. Burwell, an engineer who did the Stave Falls dam, electric dam project. Another trip that Aquila used to make was to Buccaneer Bay, where they girls remembered going out first thing in the morning to catch soles, the fish sole on the sandy shore, and put them in buckets, and then they were fried fresh for breakfast. BT apparently navigated on the trips. Certainly the Aquila had an impressive chart locker, which is at present in the possession of the company. K. Bell Irving has a recollection that the talk on the last cruise that B.T. Rogers took, this was on June the 16th and 17th, 1918, just before he died, that the talk all day was about what would Ernie do with his life. Ernie, of course, was not there. He was off to the war. B.T. used to get up for breakfast. There would be a big set lunch on board. Drinking was taken very seriously, but it was not overdone. There were no hangovers, although there might be quite a few champagne corks popping. The ship was run with naval precision. The hours were sounded by bells, six bells, four bells, etc. And everything had to be done just so. Everything had to be absolutely shipshape. And if it wasn't done just right, BT didn't like it. Swimming was also done very formally and carefully, because they swam also in cold and dangerous waters. And the ladder was let down the side of the ship for the bathers to clamber down, robed from head to foot in their funny old costumes. BT is a normal thing at home, dressed for dinner every night. And the home was run in much the same way as the ship. Everything had to be absolutely ship-shaped and Bristol fashion. BT would have nicknames for young people. His daughter Mary he called Sloppity Jane, which perhaps accounts for some of the animosity that existed between the two of them. A friend was Captain Phillips, who was commander of one of the Canada-Australia Line's ships. He was a great old crony of BT, and his Vancouver home was more or less Davy Street House. Every time the captain was in port, he stayed with the family. And he apparently was quite a live wire and a great storyteller. But Bella, BT's wife, apparently didn't particularly care for the man and tolerated him. I imagine he was possibly rather crude, but BT thought he was a fine chap. Kay Watson, now Kay Bell Irving, loved BT, and BT was very fond of her, apparently. And the ship, of course, to her was a most magnificent thing. Her home life was much more mundane than that of the Rogers family, and going on to the ship and going away for the weekend with the Rogers was the height of luxury to her. They would also have some rough crossings. The ship was not always, they used to go out sometimes in rough weather as well as calm. Of course, there was another crew member on the ship. That was a Mr. Perry, who was the cabin boy. And there was also a fireman. So that the crew of five, as mentioned by Elspeth Czerniawski, may have been more like seven. Sorry, my notes are so scattered and random, but I don't have time to sort them out more formally. I'm simply reading them into the machine, more or less as they were taken.